Good morning and welcome back to Nachiyomi. Today we start the Megillah of Koheles, Perek Aleph. Let's take a look at this Perek. We're going to do a lot of learning together, try to get a sense of the overview of the Perek, and then some points to ponder. Our Perek consists of 18 psukim, and we're going to break it down to basically two sections. The first half of the Perek is psukim Aleph to Yud Aleph. In this section, let's just do a basic step-by-step breakdown. First pasuk is what's called a Koteret. Koteret is sort of the introduction to the Sefer, and that is, it just reads, Dire Koheles ben David Melech b'Yerushalayim. These are the words of Koheles. As we know, Koheles is Shlomo Melech, congregating ideas, or set in a congregation, and the son of David in Jerusalem. Then he introduces the first thesis of the book, which is the meaninglessness of life. Havel ha-volim ha-omar Koheles, havel ha-volim ha-kol havel, everything is empty. Therefore, my Yisron la-adam b'chol ha-moloi she'amol tachas ha-shemesh. What point is there working under the sun? Everything is, it seems to be futile. He then describes how everything's in a closed system, everything really that was is. He describes how generations come, generations go, the sun shines, the wind blows, the earth is stable, the rivers all go to the sea, and the sea never fills up. Everything, so to speak, is a closed system. That's Psukim Dalet to Zion. And then he describes from Psukim Ches to Yud Aleph that also you may say, a person will say to you, there's something new. Look, we've invented something which never was before. And he says, Ein kol chadash tachas ha-shemesh. There's nothing new under the sun. Anyone who says this is new, it's kvar haya, it was before, it existed beforehand. And therefore, he so to speak, this is a sort of fatalism, a nihilism about the world. It's all going to be just the way it was. That's the first part of the Perek. The second part of the Perek now introduces his first quest, where he describes, Ani Koheles Ali Yisimelech Ali Yisrael B'Yerushalayim, as the king of Israel in Jerusalem. Again, also an indicator this must have been Shlomo, because it was the only time that he was the king over Israel. The kings there afterwards were only the kings of Judea. Anyways, nonetheless, so he describes, he says, Nosati el eslibi lidrosh losur b'chochma. He says, you know what? Maybe I can find meaning. Maybe I can find a way through my toil by looking into wisdom. And that's what he does. He says, I'm going to decide to look into all this. However, and I looked into everything, and it all is empty. That anything which is crooked can never be fixed, and that which is lacking will never really be filled. So he describes how his first quest, that's the introduction to the general section, is going to run into Perek Beis, and his first quest is Chochmah. He says, Dibartani libi limor. He says, I spoke to my heart, and he says, I am more wise than anybody who was before me in Jerusalem. And I looked into all of this, wisdom. I looked into chokhmah, das, hololos, v'sichlus, all kinds of ideas, wisdom, emptiness. And I said, this is all rayon ruach, it's all emptiness. Ki baroch chokhmah rav kas, v'yosef das, yosef machov. The more wisdom a person has, the more anger they have, the more knowledge they have, the more sorrow and pain they experience. And therefore he rejects wisdom as being, in a certain sense, the flagship of meaning in life. So again, just looking at the general Perek, first is, so to speak, a fatalistic view of the world. It seems everything is and was, there's nothing new, and kol chadas, we're all trapped in the system. That's the first part of the Perek. The second part of the Perek is, let's try to find out where meaning can be found. Experiment number one, wisdom. Wisdom doesn't work. It just creates more pain. That seems to be the overview of Perek. Let's take a look at some of the key perspectives and points to ponder in this Perek. Number one, key words that appear, concepts that appear, hevel, the idea of hevel. He describes it very clearly here, hevel ha-volim, havel ha-volim ha-omar ha-kones, havel ha-volim ha-kol havel. What is hevel? Hevel literally means breath, it literally means air. It is a metaphor of something which is lacking substance, it's empty. Most of the Mepharshim actually see this as a description, meaning, when I look around the world, I see that really nothing holds water. Everything is meaningless. Everything has a beautiful veneer. You touch it, it rubs away, and it's not there anymore. Everything is slowly deteriorating. Everything is finite and limited. That's what it seems to be. However, it's worthwhile noting that the Mitzudos and the Ramban note that this is not descriptive, but it is prescriptive. Havel does not mean hevel. Havel is make meaningless. Do not attach value to transience. Do not make your identity intertwined with your real estate. Do not say that your car is going to give you a better social status. Do not think that by paying for great vacations for your kids, you're going to create meaning and relationships with them when you don't really pay attention to them. That's what Havel Havalim is. Don't attach its significance to unimportant things in this life. If you actually read the pasuk itself about Havel, it's worthwhile noting it actually appears 7 times. Havel is 1, Havalim is 2, because the minimum of plural is 2, that's so up to 3. Havel Havalim, HaKol Havel, is another 1, 2, 1. And it gives us 7 mentions of the word Hevel in that pasuk, in the second pasuk for Koheles. Why 7 times? Rashi says because he's saying the framework of time, the week, all 7 days, all empty. It's not as, I live for my weekends. All 7 days are empty. The Gemara actually learns from here, the Gemara and Gemara Katam learns, this is the source for doing 7 ma'amados at a funeral. If you've been at a funeral, you'll notice that they stop 7 times in the procession of taking the coffin, taking the body to the ground, and it is in commemoration of this pasuk to remind those who are still alive that you may try to think that you have a legacy, but in the end of the day, we're all going to 6 feet under. Havel Havalim HaKol Havel. That's the Gemara says. A historical wrinkle. The Targum says that Shlomo said this when he saw in Nevuah that in the future his son Rechavam would split the kingdom that he spent so long and his father spent so long establishing. And therefore he says, how could it be? We can see that theme come up a number of times about children wasting away the legacy of their parents. That's the first idea. Key term number 2 is Tachas HaShemesh, under the sun. That appears a number of times in our parak and will appear numerous times throughout the Sefer. What does it mean, Tachas HaShemesh? So the Mitzvah says it means everything in this world. That's a way of saying in this universe. However, the Ibn Ezra says it means to say everything bound by time, which is actually a bigger framework. It's a bigger bracket because Tachas HaShemesh is what we experience in the solar system. But in the universe as well, everything is governed by time, represented by the sun, which is our timekeeper. Rashi has a different way of looking at it, and he says the sun is the metaphor for Torah. So what he's saying is "May Yisrael Adam ba'ochol amoloi." What purpose is there in toil? Tachas HaShemesh. If a person replaces, tachas means not under, but in place of the sun, in place of the Torah, you're going to go and spend all this time reading Reader's Digest. You're going to become an expert in stamp collecting. Whatever it is that you decide, and hobbies are fine, but if that becomes your center in place of the Torah, then you know what? It really is my Yisrael. What's the point of all of that? Is somebody going to remember you because of that? Is it going to be your legacy? Is it going to give you longevity? We move into the next section. What's the point of all these ruminations about the closed system? The rivers and the sun and the earth. And the Ibn Ezra points out that actually these are the 4 basic elements, the 4 humors, which are earth, fire, air, and water, which are described from Pesukim Dalad onwards. The earth, the sun, the wind, and the rivers are all earth, fire, air, and water. And of course, that's not just a medieval concept. That also is an expression of all matter. All matter exists in 3 phases, essentially, which is gaseous, liquid, and solid, and energy, which is the meridian of change between all 3 of them, which is the idea. So in all of those systems, nothing is lost. In fact, Rabbi Mordechai Zera Kavod in his commentary points out that there's a focus on, we'll call it the natural system, is all closed. That's the first part, the four elements. And then there's the social element, which is the next few psukim, where a person may say, oh, look, I've invented something, I've made something, I've introduced something, and that is still not new as well. Now, what this reminds us of is of a very, very concerning assertion, which was made in the year 1899. The Patent Office, the Commissioner of the U.S. Patent Office, Charles H. Duell, is quoted as saying that he said, everything that can be invented has been invented. He said this in 1899 upon the turn of the 20th century. And boy, was he mistaken. And in a certain sense, do we look at Aquinas and say, oi, well, maybe Aquinas is making the same mistake. Surely there's been many inventions. The answer is no. In fact, in physics, this is proved because there is a law which has now been proved called the conservation of matter and the conservation of energy, which means that nothing actually is new. So what's an example of this? Is that we can't destroy or create energy or atoms. They simply cycle through the system. So as an example, let's say in photosynthesis. Wow, that's the source of all energy. The reason why we have energy energy is because we eat plants or animals. Animals get their energy from plants. Plants get their energy from the sun. Wow, that's incredible. Where does that energy come from? No. What happens is that the water that they draw from H2O, which is in the ground, they take that the oxygen molecule, and using the carbon dioxide from the air, the CO2 does not create either of these. It turns them into, rearranges those molecules into glucose, C6H12O6, and oxygen O2. So it produces oxygen and glucose, two very important elements. So there's nothing new. It's all in the system. And what Coelius is saying is anything that will be reinvented is simply a reconfiguration of anything which has been up till now. And therefore, what's the point? What's the point? Do you think you've created something new? That perhaps is what's being said over here. Let's move on. Just another couple points. When that famous statement in Pasuk Tezvav, "Muvas lo yochal iskon," something which is crooked, we cannot be fixed. What does that mean? So Rashi quotes two different ways of looking at it. He quotes the Gemara, which says we could be talking about a distraction which is irreversible. For example, an adulterous relationship which creates which brings about a child. That child becomes a mamzer. That is it cannot be reversed. There's no way to reverse that unless the marriage can be invalidated. Here you've created distraction in the world, and that's a metaphor for numerous other things that human beings have done in the world, which is irreversible damage. Murder, God forbid, genocide, God forbid, on a worse level. These are irreversible evils. However, there's another way of looking at it, and if you look at most of the Mishnayos and the Gemara which describe this, it's not about destruction created, but it's about missed opportunities. That a person who lived their life and they had energy and they had the capacity to do things and they just did not pick themselves up to do anything. The Gemara gives numerous examples. A person who misses saying Kriya Shema in the morning, a person who misses eating a karban bizmanai. These are missed opportunities, and I think that we struggle with the second category that Rashi is describing over here more than the first. Yes, we obviously should avoid creating destruction, and there are many people doing it today, but a lot of us are struggling with, are we relevant? Are we contributing to this world? Because if we get to the end of life and we didn't use our lives, that's something which cannot be changed afterwards. Moving on to another question, it's interesting that Shlomo HaMelech is talking about deciding to learn and get involved in wisdom. Didn't he have all that wisdom? It sounds like Shlomo HaMelech is going to be moisef. He got the blessing of a Lev Shomer and he understood a lot of things, but he ultimately was expanding upon it. This was the experiment that he's describing here. In the end of the day, he rejects wisdom. Why does he reject wisdom? So it's interesting, Rashi quotes a very fascinating, a very beautiful idea, and that is that Shlomo HaMelech was very wise, but sometimes he was too wise. How is he? Can a person be too wise? He looked at the Torah itself and he said, you know, the Torah says, a person should not have too many horses. A king should not have too many horses. And he says, I'll have many horses, but I won't go back to the land of Egypt. He should not have too many wives. His heart should not be turned. I will marry as whoever I want and I will not turn my heart. And ultimately he was proved wrong because he was too wise. That's what the one reason is. Sometimes when we do not have the correct heart necessarily and we have too much wisdom, the wisdom substantiates and rationalizes the perspectives we've already chosen in our emotional makeup. It's worthwhile thinking about specifically now in today's era. How many things are we actually intellectually, honestly thinking about, or are we simply rationalizing and justifying the lifestyles that we prefer to lead? That's what Rashi says. However, the other aspect of this is, Ki baruch chochma rov kas, Yosef das, Yosef machov, more knowledge, more pain. The flip side, of course, of the statement is, the statement, ignorance is bliss. But how does this work? And the Mitzvot explains that the more we know about things, the more pain it is, because we start thinking about things in the future. You know, it's kind of like the lawyer who's dealing with the businessman and he's the deal killer, right? So he says, well, you know, if you get into this business, you're going to this risk and that risk and this legality and this, it's not worth it. And then the businessman says, you know what, it's just not worth it. Because thinking about too much knowledge, you need to have a certain degree of innocence or naivety in order to be able to make a decision. Because if you know too much, if a person really knew what marriage was before they get married, the responsibility, if a person knew what it was like to have a child, they would never have children. But thank God, God blesses us with a certain degree of innocence and ignorance. They were able to do things which are for our very, very best and will form and shape us and be crucibles in our lives. But it's very, very painful, and too much knowledge can be too painful. Ibn Ezra says that a person who lives with knowledge is like living with death between their eyes, because they will always live with this terrible fatalistic perspective of the future, which is why Shlomo HaMelech rejects knowledge as being the source and the flagship of meaning. In the meantime, have a wonderful, meaningful day.